This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Amid the sound and fury occasioned by former radio host Don Imus's witless and cruel characterization of the members of the Rutgers women's basketball team on April 4th, one response seems to me exceptional for the wisdom and charity it reflects. At a press conference on Tuesday, Kia Vaughn, a member of the Rutgers team, spoke of the team's intention to meet with Mr. Imus and said, "I'd like for him to get to know us." Since then, Imus has been fired by CBS, in part because he described those young women he didn't know and had probably never seen play basketball as nappy-headed hoes, and in part because most of the companies that had sponsored his radio program decided to stop doing so. Meeting with Kia Vaughn, Essence Carson, and the rest of the members of the Rutgers team on Thursday night may or may not have changed Don Imus. Ratings long ago taught him that in our culture there is a place for insults and slurs, no matter how moronic they may be. That's a hard truth to repudiate when you've been making a lot of money embracing it. But if it occurs to some of the many people who've been paying attention to this controversy that Kia Vaughn is right, and that nobody who knew her and her teammates would have made the remarks Don Imus made, some benefit may come from this otherwise irredeemable tale of ignorance and woe. It's not surprising that Coach C. Vivian Stringer, who may know the Rutgers players better than anyone except their families, talked at length about their accomplishments and the sterling qualities of the potential doctor, lawyer, and psychologist presently wearing the Rutgers colors. But by the time they've written their next term papers and run their next laps, it's likely to occur to the Rutgers players that despite the protestations of one of their number, they haven't really been scarred for life. They are already far too accomplished and self-confident to be seriously damaged by the stupid remarks of an uninformed man so irrelevant to their lives that most of them had never heard of him before last week. That's not to underestimate the idiocy of Imus and his crew, but only to suggest that the players who were the targets of their insults will be thriving long after Imus has been forgotten. At 9:35 on Monday morning, weather allowing, the 111th running of the Boston Marathon will commence when the wheelchair division breaks the starting line in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Even when there isn't rain, wind, or even snow, marathoning is not an easy sport, and for the last 2.5 decades, it's been unusually difficult for U.S. runners. It's been 24 years since an American has won the open division of the Boston Marathon, but on Monday, an American woman has a chance to break that drought. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Marathoner Dina Castor says the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista is the perfect place to get away from everyday life and focus on training. It's calm, quiet, and surrounded by recent subdivisions built into the hills, pre-planned to offer brand new gravel running trails built right in. Today, Coach Terrence Mahen will be leading Dina Castor and Team Running USA on what he describes as a recreational run. But while we're chatting, he's leaning against a bike borrowed for the occasion from Olympic pole vault gold medalist Stacy Dragila. While Mahen and his athletes are on a recreational run, I'm going to need an Olympian's bike to keep up.
Yeah, you know, these guys will go out and run somewhere 6-minute pace per mile, you know, maybe a little bit slower. But, for the general public, it's not so easy.
Dina Castor has already won the Chicago and London marathons and taken bronze at the Olympics in Athens. Now she's trying to become the first American woman to win Boston since Joan Benoit Samuelson. And her coach, at least, thinks she has a shot.
There's a high hope from a lot of people, you know. Number one from Dina, she's looking to obviously win Boston Marathon is the number one goal. Boston being, you know, the big race out there, you know, over 100 years old, it's an epic race to try to win. And so that's been the goal for, you know, the past 6 months.
The success of Dina Castor and her teammate Meb Keflezighi, who won silver in the Olympics in Athens, came as a surprise, some would even say a shock. Since the mid-1980s, with the exception of Chicago, Americans have not won any other major marathon, Boston, London, Berlin, or New York. So what's changed?
You know, I think a lot of things have changed. In the beginning was, you know, we were at such a low in U.S. distance running in 2000. We sent one female marathoner to the Olympics when we could have sent three, but we didn't have three people good enough to hit the qualifying standards. And I think that was just such a major shock to everyone in the American distance running world. It was like, so everyone put their thinking caps on and said, what do we have to do to get this going again?
Those thinking caps resulted in the USA Distance Project, an initiative to get Americans back on the winner's podium at major marathon events. It's a fundraising effort, of course, but also a change in the way American marathoners train. Instead of the lone runner hitting the pavement for 150 miles or so a week, distance runners are now being encouraged to train in groups. It's an idea that was borrowed from the Kenyans and Ethiopians, the dominant distance runners of today, and also from the American runners in the 70s and 80s, when Mahen says American marathoning was at its peak.
And out of those groups, we had the Frank Shorters, the Bill Rogers, the Joan Samuelsons, the Alberto Salazars, who were the big icons and big players in the world. And then the group seemed to just fade out, whether it was financial reasons or what. And then, you know, in hand, American distance running faded out.
The loss of America's running teams not only made it harder for distance runners to train and get access to great coaching, it also became harder for athletes to find sponsorship. Jill Geer of USA Track and Field says the Distance Project and its focus on team training aimed to change that.
It's easier for a team to attract financial sponsors than it is for one individual. And it also helps to spread the money around as well. So if you have a team with one or two great athletes, you can really market that team to corporate America and draw in money that will then support those up-and-coming runners, because it's the up-and-comers who end up making the difference 4, 5, 6 years from now.
No one expected the Distance Project to show results right away. That's because it takes 8, 9, even 10 years for distance runners to really hit their stride.
An example of that is actually the Hansons-Brooks Distance Project, which has been part of the USA Distance Project, and they had 6 guys in the top 20 at Boston last year, which was incredible. Now, they started out as sort of a national club of decent national athletes, but over the years, they've developed into an elite club, and they've also seen their sponsorship increase over the years. Now, that's probably not an accident. You know, money helps athletes be able to devote the time they need to train.
Traditionally, most of a runner's income comes from the shoe companies, and that's not likely to change. But the USA Distance Project aims to widen those sponsorship opportunities to include everything from car dealerships to local banks. And the seed money to start the USA Distance Project came from the marathon organizations themselves, like the New York Roadrunners and their president, Mary Wittenberg.
I think it's the toughest sport in the world. Running marathons and distance running, there's no timeouts. There's no breaks in the action, and you've got to run, you know, upward of 150 miles a week to be able to even step to the line with a chance at winning. So we needed to promote our athletes. We need to give more prize money opportunities. We need to give more appearance money. We need to generate more buzz about them.
The New York Roadrunners bootstrapped the USA Distance Project by pledging $1 for every entrant in the New York City Marathon. In recent years, the club's support has increased tenfold, and Wittenberg says she's still looking for new revenue sources to increase funding even further. But it's not all about money. Wittenberg says in 2000 and 2001, when it was all doom and gloom for American distance runners on the international stage, high schoolers like Alan Webb and Ryan Hall were breaking records and proving that Americans had the potential to be international players.
We saw the seeds had been planted, but they needed nurturing. And I think for a couple decades there, as a sport, we weren't nurturing our athletes after high school and college, and we weren't helping them. We were not at all paving the way to a sport that provided the glory and the incentive to stay in our sport.
Ironically, in the 1990s, while Americans were experiencing a drought on the winner's podium, more and more recreational runners were signing up to run marathons and other distance events. The New York City Marathon uses a lottery system to keep the entrants at a reasonable number, and many of the club's other events are filled beyond capacity as well. So what's in it for the New York Roadrunners to raise money for American athletes? Wittenberg admits that an American champion won't help her fit more people on the starting line of the New York City Marathon, but it will help with some of the club's more lofty goals.
Well, I'm a big believer in American stars. That's what's going to help us get kids running. It certainly helps even adults of all ages and abilities get moving. I mean, look what Tiger Woods has done for golf. And the more that people are paying attention to the big deal event, and the more people recognize that, the more it's going to help them get moving and aspire to be fitter and healthier themselves.
Really?
I'd make fun of you.
Yeah, you made fun of me.
I made fun of Andrew for saying that.
It's 2.5 weeks before the Boston Marathon when I joined Dina Castor and seven other members of Team Running USA for their morning recreational run. Terrence Mahen says these easy runs are necessary for his athletes to recover from hard training days and rediscover their love of running. They also look like a lot of fun. The team chats about everything from the difference between a moth and a butterfly to last night's American Idol. They also run fast, very, very fast. I can follow on the flats, but once Dina Castor and Team Running USA hit the hill trails, I can't even match their pace on a bicycle, and they leave me in the dust. Later, in a sunny room at the Olympic Training Center cafeteria, I meet up again with Dina Castor. While in Chula Vista, the team spends hours a day in this room, chatting and laughing while they eat and recover from workouts. Castor knows that her team provides quite a contrast from the stereotypical solo American marathoner, pounding out mile after lonely mile on the pavement.
Yeah, with pain and struggle, and I guess it gets instilled in physical education at a very early age. But I remember in school that running was always a punishment, that if you didn't dress right for PE, you had to go run 2 laps, a half mile around the soccer field. And I think now people are realizing, as 100,000 people try to join major marathons in the United States and around the world, when that many people are trying to get on the starting line of a race, I think they've pretty much gotten that running is a celebration.
Lots of things make Dina Castor smile. She giggles when her husband steals her chocolate chip cookie at lunch. She beams at the thought of becoming the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1983. But her biggest smile comes when she considers the future of her sport.
It's only the beginning. It's only the tip of the iceberg on what we're going to see in the future when this momentum continues. Distance running is something everybody can relate to, and I think because of that, we're going to see a huge resurgence, not just in performances, but in the fan base as well.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Chula Vista, California.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the National Basketball Developmental League, as a proving ground for coaches. But first, in a recent Globe and Mail article, writer Stephen Brunt invoked Charles Dickens to describe the states of the Toronto Raptors, which last Saturday captured its first division title after many years of futility, and the Toronto Maple Leafs, who missed the NHL playoffs by a mere point. Stephen Brunt joins me now on the line from Toronto to discuss the tales of that city's sports franchises, which are headed in opposite directions. Stephen, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Let's start with the Toronto Raptors. How have local fans reacted to the team's first ever division title?
Well, I guess with surprise, shock, delight. It certainly was unexpected this year, and this is a team that has had its ups and downs, and mostly downs. But really, since Vince Carter left town in under a cloud of all kinds of things, it's been pretty bleak. So this was a year when, if you looked at the pundits, all the big NBA writers, I think they had the Toronto Raptors to be the worst team in the National Basketball Association. And at this stage, a lot of people think they might be in the top five teams in the entire league.
With only a few days left in the regular season, the Raptors are battling to maintain home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs. Obviously, the team has exceeded expectations, but is it built to really go the distance in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think in the East anyway. The East is so wide open right now, and every team has issues, with the possible exception of Detroit. Just about everybody that's going to be in the playoffs has issues of one sort or another. And the Raptors have... They have managed to survive. They've had some very tough injuries/illnesses in the last little while. They had Andrea Bargnani, who was the number one draft pick from a year ago. The Italian went down with appendicitis, had ended up having an emergency appendectomy. So he's coming back soon. And Jorge Garbajosa, one of the two Spanish players they have in the lineup, suffered a terrible ankle leg injury. He's gone for the year. But they don't seem to have missed a beat. And there's a confidence around that team right now that would suggest that they're not intimidated by anybody or any situation. Now, you don't know when they get into the playoffs, who knows? But I'm not sure I'd bet against them with anybody in the East right now.
Not so long ago, this team was the punchline to a lot of NBA jokes. As recently as a year ago, really, how have they turned things around so convincingly?
Well, I guess they hired the right guy, which is the, would be the short answer, in Brian Colangelo, who came over from Phoenix because he couldn't get along with the new owners there and you know, was an executive of the year with the Phoenix Suns and has brought that kind of magic to Toronto as well. They got lucky in some instances. They found some other people to take some terrible contracts off their hands. I don't know if people realize, Bill, and I don't think people in the States do, but going right back to the beginning with this as an expansion franchise, this was a team bought by people who didn't have the money to build an arena and were probably the wrong group to give a team to. There was an aspect of flimflammery with this thing from the very beginning. They have had a series of star players who they drafted who wanted to get out of town as fast as they could because they couldn't handle being in a different country. You know, Damon Stoudemire and then Vince Carter. It has been an absolutely star-crossed franchise. And for everything to go right suddenly and to have a guy at the helm who everybody believes in is... There's a lot of cynicism has evaporated in a very short time. Let's put it that way.
Well, as you say, everything has gone right all of a sudden. Does the approach presently operating there suggest that this team can keep winning?
Well, their best young player, Chris Bosch, who is the most recent in the line of superstars or budding superstars who they've drafted, has committed to Toronto long term contractually. So he's going to be around, and he's just coming into his own. The core of the team is very young, and they've been very progressive in terms of this is something that none of the previous Toronto administrations did, but they have really tapped into the European market, the non-American market for basketball players with Garbajosa and even Anthony Parker coming over who was playing in Israel. They've got an Italian assistant general manager who ran the Benetton franchise in the Italian league. So they've become kind of progressive in terms of world basketball and where the game is going. So I don't think there's any reason why this wouldn't continue. And for a change, there appears to be no one at the top who's going to immediately screw it up.
Well, you have cited management, good management, as one of the reasons for the Raptors' success. The same company, Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, runs both franchises, the Raptors and the Maple Leafs. What are the differences in the way the Raptors and Leafs are run? And if they are different, why is there a difference?
Well, I guess the biggest difference is that... In terms of the realities of running those two franchises in Toronto, is that with the Raptors, they still have to sell tickets and they still have to build interest. Despite this great run the franchise has had, the TV numbers especially, they've done pretty well with filling the building this year, but their television ratings are abysmal. So they have to work harder with basketball and they've had to try harder to sell basketball. And hockey, it doesn't matter what you do. You know, the Toronto Maple Leafs have been sold out since I was born. And it's true. And you can put any product on the ice. And now, not to suggest that they haven't spent money, but they've had this fantastic kind of cash machine going for years and years and years. And there is no real pressure to put a competitive product on the ice because as long as you give people a few playoff games every once in a while, you know, the fact that they haven't won a championship in 40 years doesn't seem to matter.
Are you suggesting that fans of the Maple Leafs are just, they're not complaining, even though they just missed the playoffs right after the Raptors had clinched a playoff spot?
Oh, they're complaining, and they do complain, but they complain about it with this sense of inevitability that it doesn't really matter what they say or do. And the stunning thing about Toronto Maple Leafs fans is the difference would be if you look at places like, you know, other original six NHL cities that have fallen on hard times, Boston for one.
You think?
Yeah, that would be one. Chicago would be another one. You know, those arenas are half empty now. Hmm. And Chicago is the only one of the old franchises that has gone longer without a Stanley Cup than the Leafs have. But there has been a level of, again, a cynicism built up in those markets because people don't believe in the ownership. The Wirtz family and the Jacobs in Boston alienated a lot of people. But in Toronto, look, it's 40 years of absolute futility. You've gone from individual ownership to more corporate ownership. But if you give them a little glimmer of hope, it's as though they're wide-eyed again. Spontaneous parades break out, street celebrations on Yonge Street in Toronto, the main drag in Toronto, when they've won a playoff series. Like one series, first round series, there's horn honking and people dancing in the street. So I don't know what it is about them, but they ought to be the most beaten down, world weary fans in the world. But in fact, they're like little kids as soon as you give them something.
So you haven't, the newspaper hasn't been swamped with calls for the raptorization of the Maple Leafs, I gather.
Well, it's like they're kind of like in the old westerns. They used to have the cattlemen and the sheepmen, right? They were always at war with each other. And there's a gulf here between the hockey crowd and the basketball crowd. And the basketball crowd, by and large, is younger. It is more diverse. Mm-hmm. It looks more like the city in a lot of ways because this is an incredibly diverse city. The hockey crowd is more of an old school, old money, old Canadian crowd. And, you know, I think on some level the hockey guys resent everything good that happens to the basketball guys. And the basketball crowd loves to tweak the old traditional franchise and point out that, you know, again, after several years of being very, very down, that their franchise is now on the way up.
Stephen Brunt writes for the Globe and Mail and is the author of Searching for Bobby Orr, published by Vintage Canada. Stephen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Great talking to you again, Bill.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast.
I wanted to be in basketball. This is what I truly know, I truly love, and I could see myself doing lots of other work or jobs, but, I mean, you're supposed to try and do something that makes you happy and that you can give back in, and I think this is it.
That's the late Dennis Johnson, whose distinguished NBA career included 5 All-Star Game appearances and 3 championships. Before Johnson's untimely death at the age of 52 on February 22nd, he had been head coach of the National Developmental Basketball League's Austin Toros and had served as an assistant with the Boston Celtics and as an interim head coach with the Los Angeles Clippers. His oft-stated dream was a return to the NBA. Though the NBDL was created by the NBA as a way to develop young players who aren't quite ready for the prime time, it's also seen as a training ground for aspiring coaches, though none have yet made the leap. Ben Philpott of member station KUT in Austin reports.
The 12-team D-League is the NBA's version of minor league baseball. Each of the teams is affiliated with one or more NBA teams. Each NBA team can send up to 2 rookies or second-year players to its D-League affiliate. The team completes its roster with former college or European players, all of whom are hoping the D-League will be their big chance to make it in the NBA. About 2,000 fans cheer on the Austin Toros and Tulsa 66ers during a regular season game in Austin. The Toros' small home court makes the fans sound louder than you'd expect. Just like in minor league baseball, these fans are hoping to get a close-up look at a future star. More than 80 players have made that jump to the NBA during the D-League's 6-year history.
Let's go 22, but what I'd like to see is, instead of denying Gillespie, let Gillespie come get it, you know what I'm saying? Instead of denying him, deny the other guy, make Gillespie, because he's really shaky right now, he's a little scared.
Tulsa 66ers coach Joey Meyer has had 3 of his players called up just this year. Meyer coached for 11 seasons as an assistant at DePaul under his dad, the legendary Ray Meyer, and went on to serve as the team's head coach for 13 seasons. Meyer says adapting to the pro game, along with the constant roster changes and NBA ambitions, can make it hard to coach in the NBDL.
They all have individual goals that you've got to get into a team goal. In some years, you know, you do it, and some years you don't. I think, you know, the rules are different. The game's different. It really is. I mean, the college game is different for this. The 3-second defense, the longer 3-point line, the 24-second shot clock. There are a lot of different rules that make this a different game than the college game.
Meyer has successfully crafted a team goal more often than not. During his 6 years in the D-League, he's won 2 championships. This year's team ended the season below 500. Through it all, Meyer has kept his own competitive fires burning the same way his players do, with thoughts of making it to the NBA.
I really want to try to get involved in coaching in the NBA level, and I thought this was the best way because I had coached college, I guess I have to admit this, for 26 years. So, you know, I decided the only way to learn the NBA game is to coach it. So my goal is kind of like theirs, is to try to get a chance to get to the bench in the NBA.
Take a look around the league and you'll find former NBA players, assistants, and even a couple of NBA interim coaches. Sioux Falls Skyforce head coach Mo McCone had his own short stay at the end of the bench in 1984 when he was named interim head coach of the San Antonio Spurs. McCone believes the D-League offers a way to reconnect with the NBA for those who may have coached in other countries.
I came into the D-League because I've been in Asia, coaching in Korea, and that kind of took me off the radar screen, and I'm just trying to get back on the radar screen a little bit.
McCone says it's probably not realistic to think he'd get another chance as an NBA head coach, but he says as the D-League expands, he can envision his ideal job.
A perfect position would be to be working for a team like the San Antonio Spurs and being their D-League coach and just having a relationship where you would be with them some of the year, then you would go back after the D-League season with and work with them. And to me, that would be that'd be a really fun situation to be in.
While McCone hopes coaching in the D-League gets him to the NBA, he acknowledges that the league prioritizes the development of players. Tulsa 66ers coach Joey Meyer doubts the league will provide the NBA with an infusion of many new coaches.
No, I don't think so. I think they're going to hire who they want to hire. If there's a D-League, there isn't a D-League. Obviously gives them a chance to evaluate guys a little bit more. But really, it's more a lot of coaching is relationships, and you got to feel comfortable with that guy.
Albuquerque Thunderbirds coach and former NBA All-Star Michael Cooper agrees. He views the D-League's main goal as training players, front office workers, and referees, with coaches at the bottom of the list. But that doesn't mean he's not hoping for his own chance to move up the coaching ranks.
And if that door to the NBA opens, I wouldn't turn it down. It'd be a great opportunity. But if it doesn't open, I'm not about crying over spilled milk. I'm just going to go to the next opportunity that I have that involves me and that keeps me into coaching.
Late last week, that next opportunity for Cooper came along. He was named head coach of the WNBA's LA Sparks. It's Cooper's second stint with the team he led to back-to-back WNBA titles in 2001 and 2002. For Only a Game, I'm Ben Philpott in Austin.
You're listening to Only a Game. Letters, we get letters, and sometimes it's because mistakes, I make mistakes. In last week's conversation with Charlie Pierce, I brought up Suni Williams, the astronaut who will be running on a treadmill at the same time the Boston Marathon is being contested on Monday. I said Ms. Williams would be 238,000 miles from Boston at the time, but that would be impossible unless she was going to be on the moon. In fact, she will be on the International Space Station, which is only 225 miles above the Earth. Only. Thanks to Adina Schutzberg, a WBUR listener, and Ed Bride, who hears Only a Game on WAMC in Albany. They were among the listeners who corrected me. Don Dobris, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland, caught another mistake when I referred to J.D. Quinn as a former member of the Ohio State football team. It was the Oklahoma team that kicked Mr. Quinn out for taking money from a team booster. Mr. Quinn now plays his football for Montana, not to be confused with Michigan, at least by me. Okay, Bill Littlefield, that's how an email from Alex McDonald of Lincoln, Vermont began. I feared things would not go well after that opening, and they didn't. What is the reason for the lack of coverage of the Frozen Four on this Saturday's broadcast, he wrote. Mr. McDonald was referring to the men's college ice hockey championships. As journalists, you passed up some good stories by ignoring this competition, he said, and he is no doubt right. We cannot be everywhere at once, which was also my reply to Sunil Sika, a WBUR listener whom we dismayed by not revisiting the Cricket World Cup, which, by the way, was won by Australia. And finally, we had an email from Pat Little, another WAMC listener, who came across a description of ice hockey written by a high school student from Madagascar who is spending the winter with a family in Maine. Crazy people run with knives on feet, make combat with tree arms, the young man wrote. And then, it poetic. Send your comments, poetic or otherwise, to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or leave a message on the listener line at 617-353-1860.
Second period, turn it up. Where players dash, the skates a flash, the home team trails behind. They grab the puck and go rushing up, down across the line. They storm the crease like bumblebees, they travel like a
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Jackie Robinson's first season, recalled on the 60th anniversary of Same. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Thursday, longtime CBS radio host Don Imus was fired for insulting comments that he made about the black members of the Rutgers women's basketball team. Are you surprised that the firing came as swiftly as it did?
No, I think that this was a camel carrying a great many straws. I think there's a lot of soul searching to be done by a lot of influential people in my business and in the political business as to why they enabled this pathetic 70-year-old bad boy for as long as they did. He finally did something to some victims that the society in general wouldn't tolerate. And even though there's kind of a loathsome backlash going on now against Vivian Stringer and this team about them being quote-unquote used for X, Y, and Z, and what about rap music, and what about the Duke case, and blah, 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 the fact remains any professional communicator who said anything like this on a national microphone should be fired. And who I really admire through all this are the NBC News employees who apparently said, hold enough, and went to their bosses and said, him or us.
Right, and this was well before he was fired, actually. Imus met with the coaches, players, and parents of the players on Thursday night. This was after he'd lost his job. Coach C. Vivian Stringer of Rutgers made comments indicating that she felt Imus, quote, stole their dreams, and one player said she was scarred for life as a result of his comments. This may be a bit of hyperbole.
I think they may feel this way now. I don't think they'll feel this way in a year. I don't think the player will feel her life has been scarred when she's 30 years old and telling her children about this great season they had.
And practicing medicine somewhere.
Or playing the piano or whatever.
Exactly.
I think it's probably hyperbole, but I think what was done to them gives them a right to a few days of hyperbole before this fades away.
This week, many cited the current controversy over Imus as proof that no progress has been made in this country regarding attitudes towards race and gender. But given that he's now off the air and that major companies like General Motors, Nextel, Sprint, American Express, Staples, I could go on, distanced themselves from Imus before he was fired, maybe a case can be made that there has been progress.
Well, I mean, let's see. I mean, for all the bloviating about rap music, and why can they say this and we can't and blah, 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 which is a variation on an old and very stupid argument. Let's see if it has any effect on the sponsors of people like Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and Glenn Beck, who has his own national television show. Let's go see if the political dialogue gets cleaned up in this country. Why you're seeing all this dust thrown up about rap music is because people don't want to concentrate on the kind of polite obscenity that white talk show hosts, particularly white conservative talk show hosts in this country, have been trafficking in for 15 years.
Charlie, Adam Pac-Man Jones, against whom Las Vegas police have recommended felony and misdemeanor charges stemming from a fight and a shooting in Las Vegas last February, has been suspended for the entire 2007 National Football League season. Is this an indication that the new boss of the NFL is not the same as the old boss?
Yeah, Mr. Goodell is putting down the law. The completely useless NFL Players Association is going along with it. Everyone's cheering. Everyone's having a happy, good time. And every football player in the National Football League's immediate career is now in the hands of any cowboy cop who wants to bust them outside a nightclub or while they're driving their car home from practice. This is going to be a masterpiece of unintended consequences down the road.
The NFL's new conduct policy, which was released on Tuesday, moments after Jones and Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chris Henry were suspended, will apparently apply to all NFL employees. Do you think it'll be enforced evenly among all NFL employees?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure that Mr. Goodell will step right up and take an owner's team away from him if the owner is convicted of pension fraud or something in his outside business. I'm also sure that donkeys are flying outside my window right now.
More than a year after three Duke University lacrosse players were accused of sexual assault, all charges have been dropped. Durham County District Attorney Mike Nifong has apologized to the players for his incorrect judgment, which is quite a phrase. On Thursday, the New York Post published a front-page photo of the accuser in the Duke case, along with the headline, "The Duke Liar, Now America Can See Her Face." Has justice been served for anybody involved in this case?
Well, I think justice is going to be served on Prosecutor Nifong, but I wouldn't sit here and let's congratulate ourselves. Reed Seligman, one of the players, mentioned in the press conference that the scales had fallen from his eyes, and he saw how little the country respects the notion of innocent until proven guilty and the various legal protections that were written into the Constitution to avoid this very, keep this very thing from happening. Really? Congratulations, son. Welcome to the United States of America in 2007. 13 people who were convicted, not merely accused, but convicted of crimes walked out of a prison in Texas because the DA down there had phonied up DNA results last week. If you're concerned about due process and the right of someone to be considered innocent until they're proven guilty, where do we put Guantanamo? Where do we put... This is what we encourage. We cheer prosecutors who do this. We applaud prosecutors to do when they do this. And when we do that, every time we do that, we make a Mike Nifong not only possible, but inevitable.
Kevin Durant, the University of Texas basketball player regarded as either the best or next best pro prospect, announced this week that he will enter the 2007 NBA draft. Would he be enough to resuscitate the Celtics, Grizzlies, Bucks, Sonics, Hawks, Blazers, or Bobcats?
I'm not. I mean, he would be enough to resuscitate a few of them. It's going to be very interesting down the line if Greg Oden decides to stay at Ohio State. I don't think he will. I think he's going to come out, and I think he will be the first pick in the draft. But if he's not, it's Kevin Durant and a crapshoot. Because Kevin Durant will score 20 points a game his first year in the NBA. Whether that will be enough to resuscitate any of the franchises that you name, who can say? But he will be the first pick in the draft until Greg Oden makes up his mind.
The NHL playoffs started with a bang. Vancouver,
is that one? Is it still going on?
Months. Vancouver defeated Dallas in four overtimes on Wednesday night. Four, count them, four. The Sharks won in only two overtimes. Too bad nobody can see these games.
It's remarkable. I watched a couple of the games. I watched two of the overtimes. And I watched the games the other night when the Rangers got their first playoff win in an awfully long time. They're on the Versus Network, which is the formerly the Outdoor Life channel. The hockey camera work is, shall we say, rudimentary at best. And I think when you count up all the things the NHL has done wrong in the last 20 years, spurning ESPN a while back, which really loved the NHL and did a great job televising it in favor of whatever it was they spurned it for, is going to go down in history, along with wiping out an entire season, as the worst decision they ever made.
Fans here in New England can take some solace in the fact that they didn't have the worst weather during baseball's opening week. That distinction would go to the Cleveland Indians.
Cleveland, the weather was so bad in Cleveland, they had to go to Milwaukee. Go figure that. And it snowed there, too, but the roof was closed.
Didn't matter. They played indoors.
So they got to play, you know, Major League Baseball, do better at the beginning of the year. There's no reason for Tampa to open the season on the road, none at all. You know, if you're going to play baseball in the upper latitudes in April and November, you're going to have moments like this.
And finally, Charlie, Peru's loss to Japan in a friendly soccer match last month did not seem to dismay Julio Uribe. He's Peru's coach. He went dancing after the 2-0 defeat, and I bet he wishes he hadn't done so.
You can tell by the way he used his walk, he's a woman's man, no time to talk. Yeah, he went to a disco and apparently got down and boogied in such a way that the Peruvian national soccer panjandrums decided he was inappropriately sad. Uribe, next time, throw yourself in the river.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Sixty years ago tomorrow, Jackie Robinson took the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers, becoming the first black man to play Major League Baseball in the 20th century. In Opening Day, the story of Jackie Robinson's first season, Jonathan Eig explores the oft-told tale of Robinson's initial season with the Dodgers. He joins me now from NPR's New York studios. Jonathan, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's great to be with you again.
The story of Jackie Robinson is pretty well known, even if there has been some fiction mixed in with the fact over the years. What led you to write a book about Robinson's experience?
Well, I wanted to strip away the fiction, first of all, and figure out where the fact really began and ended. And I also thought that by crystallizing the story in one season, 1947, you could really get at the core of Robinson's legend. You can really figure out what he meant to America in that very specific amount of time. And you had the great fun of following a terrific baseball team on the race for a pennant. So I fell in love with the story.
You write that when Jackie Robinson first entered the Dodger clubhouse, only two members of the team walked over to shake his hand. One of them was Ralph Branca, and the other was Gene Hermansky. How did you learn that?
That was a detail that Robinson himself gave to one of the black writers covering the story that day. A lot of white papers didn't really cover the game too well and buried the story about integration altogether, but the black papers in the country were all over it. They covered every detail. They even reported on who sat next to Robinson in the dugout that day. They were looking for every angle.
You write that when Robinson took the field for Brooklyn for the first time, quote, the sight jolted some of the spectators as if a man in shoulder pads and a football helmet had run across the baseball diamond. But hadn't fans in Brooklyn been pretty well prepared for Robinson's debut?
Not so much, actually. You know, he'd been down in Cuba training in spring training, and even then it was not clear whether he would make the team. On April 10th, when Brent Rickey finally announced it, it was just 5 days before opening day, and even then, Rickey did not say whether Robinson would be his starting first baseman. So fans came out to the ballpark. They knew that Robinson was a part of the team yet, but they weren't sure whether they were going to see him or not, and they had never seen anything like it. They'd never seen a black man in a Dodger uniform.
At least one of the people, former Brooklyn residents whom you quote in the book, suggests that Brooklyn was the perfect place for this integration to occur. Explain to me the reasoning behind that contention.
Well, Brooklyn was a place for strivers. It was a place for immigrants, and everybody there wanted better than what they had. And in that respect, they could identify with Jackie Robinson. They might not have known much about African-American culture. They might not have known what it felt like to be exposed to the kind of racism that Jackie was. But Italians, Irishmen, Jews, they all knew what it was like to be a minority. And as soon as Robinson started to prove himself as a Dodger, first of all, they were so passionate about the Dodgers that he became a bum. And that, in some ways, trumped his color. But in another way, he represented all of those people who were trying to make something better of their lives.
Red Barber, who had initially wondered if he could continue broadcasting Dodgers games when Branch Rickey pulled him aside and told him that Robinson would be joining the team, came up with a wonderful phrase, I thought, to describe the rookie on that first day.
I love this. It's one of my favorite details. He didn't refer to Jackie's race. He said, Jackie Robinson is definitely a brunette. That's poetry.
One of the most oft-told stories about Robinson is that on one particularly tough day, Pee Wee Reese, the Dodgers shortstop, walked across the infield and put his arm around Robinson's shoulders in order to show fans his support for his teammate, even though Pee Wee was a Southerner, grew up in Kentucky. My goodness, this has been everywhere in a children's book and everywhere else. Were you able to confirm that that event actually happened?
Sadly, no. I can certainly say that Pee Wee Reese was out front among the Dodgers in embracing Robinson, that he was a very good friend of Robinson over the years. But in 1947, it's hard to tell whether Pee Wee was sort of waiting and watching like the other guys or whether he made any overt gestures. But that particular one in 1947 does not appear to be backed up with any contemporaneous evidence. There are no pictures. There are no newspaper accounts from 1947. In fact, Robinson, right after the game in Cincinnati, where this was supposed to have happened, told one of the black reporters that he was thrilled by how well he was received by the crowd. So there's no indication that there was even any taunting going on that day.
During that first year, Jackie Robinson roomed with Wendell Smith, a black newspaper writer whom Branch Rickey had hired. In fact, Rickey was paying him the same salary that his newspaper was paying him. What were Mr. Smith's duties with the Dodgers?
Wendell Smith had many duties. One of them, before Jackie Robinson came to the team, was scouting for Branch Rickey, and he's the guy who said, you should take a look at this Jackie Robinson kid. And Branch Rickey said, you mean the football player from UCLA? But once Jackie started playing with the Dodgers, Wendell Smith had to chaperone him around town. He had to find hotels for him to stay when they went to certain cities like St. Louis, where Jackie wasn't welcomed in the white-only hotels. He had to find restaurants. He had to find black taxi cabs that would drive Robinson around town. And he was also Robinson's ghostwriter, I should mention, that Robinson had a weekly column in the Pittsburgh Courier, and Wendell Smith wrote it for him.
Smith, of course, faced his own problems. Even after Robinson integrated Major League Baseball, some of the press boxes were not open to Smith.
That's right. Wendell Smith had to cover these games often from the stands because he couldn't get into the press boxes. Only in the World Series did he finally get a press pass, and he was very proud. He began his all his columns from the World Series with the dateline, not from Yankee Stadium, but from press box Yankee Stadium, because he wanted to tell his readers that he, too, like Jackie Robinson, had broken through that color barrier.
You present the experiences of a number of people who saw Jackie Robinson play back in 1947. One of the most powerful of those experiences involves Douglas Wilder, who eventually became the governor of Virginia.
Yes, this is a wonderful story. Doug Wilder was 14 years old at the time and a huge St. Louis Cardinals fan living in Richmond. And he heard that some of the older guys in town, guys who hung around the barbershop in his neighborhood, were driving to Brooklyn to see Jackie Robinson play. And it happened to be a game against the Cardinals, so he asked if he could come along. He really didn't care much about going to see Jackie Robinson, didn't appreciate that, but he was a 14-year-old baseball fan and wanted to see his favorite team. But he gets to the game, and he watches a terrific ball game, and in extra innings, Enos Slaughter, one of his favorite players, comes down the line and spikes Jackie Robinson in the back of the foot. And it appears to many people in the crowd, it appeared to Jackie Robinson and appeared to Doug Wilder that it was intentional. Suddenly, Doug Wilder says, it was as if a light bulb had gone off in his head that he had been rooting for the wrong team, that the Cardinals were not his team. They were not playing for him, but Jackie Robinson was. Jackie Robinson was playing for his people and for his future. And he said that it was a powerful, powerful moment that he never forgot.
On opening day this season, the current Dodgers all wore number 42. All the major league teams have retired number 42 in honor of Jackie Robinson's achievement. There may have been a time when younger players weren't aware of what Robinson accomplished, but has baseball sufficiently addressed that problem?
I think baseball has done a great job of honoring Robinson's legacy, and they should be very proud of it. It's not too many sports that can say that they were out front in a movement as important as civil rights to this country. You know, the war had just ended in 1947. We were still deciding what kind of a democracy we wanted to be. And baseball helped show where we could go with this, where what kind of country we could become. I think it should be a national holiday.
Jonathan Eig is the author of Opening Day, the story of Jackie Robinson's first season, published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the NPR studios in New York. Jonathan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Yes! And that ain't all, he's so whole!
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Maggie. I'm Seriously Walking Haskins. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Opening Day, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Opening Day author Jonathan Eig, who responds to my observation that it had only been a year since we spoke to him about his biography of Lou Gehrig.
Don't compare me to John Feinstein. I'm not in his league.
Well, that's true, because in the time it took Eig to say that, three new Feinstein books arrived on my desk. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.